And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is March the 8th, the 67th day of the year. 298 days until the year's over with. The holidays and observances, which you all have asked me to make mention of. What happened to him? I had it all. Well, I had it. Now, oh, there we go. Holidays and observances. International Women's Day. National Oregon Day, National Freelancers Day, International Grant Professionals Day, National Middle Name Pride Day, National Peanut Cluster Day, National Proofreading Day, Be Nasty Day, National Science and Engineering Day, National Salt Awareness Week, Chocolate Chip Cookie Week, Butcher's Week, Teen Tech Week, Words Matter Week, National Breakfast Week, Return Borrowed Books Week, Read an E-book Week, National School Social Work Week, Dental Assistant Recognition Week, National Consumer Protection Week, National Professional Pet Sitters Week, a job a lot of people aspire to, British Pie Week, Telecommuter Appreciation Week, No More Week, Women in Construction Week, and National Procrastination Week. People born on this date, Freddie Prinze Jr. Then it's the Great Daffodil Appeal Month, National Reading Month, Veggie Month, National Sauce Month, National Peanut Month, National Colon Cancer Awareness Month, Epilepsy Awareness Month, Developmental Disability Awareness Month, Brain Tumor Awareness Month, National Women's History Month, National Nutrition Month, National Hemophilia Awareness Month, National Social Work Month, National Small Press Month, Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, National Caffeine Awareness Month, National Umbrella Month, National Kidney Month, National Craft Month, International Ideas Month, National Credit Education Month, National Cheerleading Safety Month, Endometriosis Awareness Month, Rising Star Month, National Music in Our Schools Month, Irish American History Month, and National Athletic Training Month. And let's see. Well, it's like trying to grab smoke today. Now you see it, now you don't. 1610, Ferdowsi completes his epic poem, Shah Nameh, 1126. Following the death of his mother, Queen Eureka of Leon, Alfonso VII is proclaimed King of Leon. 1262, Battle of Hustenbergen between bourgeois militia and army of the Bishop of Strasbourg. 1558, the city of Pori is founded by a Duke John on the shores of the Gulf of Bothnia. 1658, Treaty of Roskilde. After a devastating defeat in the Northern Wars, Frederick III, the King of Denmark-Norway, is forced to give up nearly half his territory to Sweden. The Northern Wars is a term used for a series of wars fought in Northern and Northeastern Europe from 16th to the 18th century. International agreed on nomenclature for these wars has not yet been devised, and while the Great Northern War is generally considered to be the last of the Northern Wars, there are different scholarly opinions on which war constitutes the first Northern War. Most historians, when in doubt, argue But there were quite a number of them. 1702. Queen Anne, the younger sister of Mary II, becomes Queen Regnant of England, Scotland, and Ireland. 1722. The Safavid Empire of Iran is defeated by an army from Afghanistan at the Battle of Gonabad. 1736. Nader Shah, founder of the Afsharid dynasty, is crowned Shah of Iran. The 1775, an anonymous writer, thought to, by some to be Thomas Paine, publishes African Slavery in America, first article in the American colonies, calling for the emancipation of slaves and the abolition of slavery. 1782, Manhattan Massacre. 96 Native Americans in Gunnedenhutten, Ohio, who had converted to Christianity, are killed by Pennsylvania militiamen in retaliation for raids carried out by other Indian tribes. When in doubt, just shoot the closest one. 1801, War of the Second Coalition. The Battle of Aboukir, a British force under Sir Ralph Abercrombie, lands in Egypt with the aim of ending the French campaign in Egypt and Syria. 1844, King Oscar I ascends to the thrones of Norway and Sweden. Also that same year, in 1844, the Althing, the Parliament of Iceland, was reopened after 45 years of closure. 1868, Sakai Incident. A Japanese samurai killed 11 French sailors in the port of Sakai, Osaka. 1910, French aviator Raymond de la Roche becomes the first woman to receive a pilot's license. I guess it's Raymonda. 1916, World War I. British force unsuccessfully attempts to relieve the siege of Kut, present-day Iraq, and the Battle of Duhailah. 1917, International Women's Day. Protest in Petrograd marked the beginning of the February Revolution. Also in 1917, the U.S. Senate votes to limit filibusters by adopting the cloture rule. For those who are not familiar with it. Also informally known as the guillotine. It's a motion or process and parliamentary procedure aimed to bring debate to a quick end. Originated in the French National Assembly, from which the name is taken. Cloture is French for the act of terminating something. Introduced in the Parliament of the UK by William Ewart Gladstone to overcome the obstructionism of the Irish Parliamentary Party and made permanent in 1887. And it was subsequently adopted by the United States Senate and other legislatures. The name cloture remains in the U.S. In Commonwealth countries, it's usually closure or informally guillotine. In the U.K., closure and guillotine are distinct motions. Okay. 1921. Spanish Prime Minister Eduardo Dato Iradiera is assassinated while on his way home from the Parliament building in Madrid. 1924. A mine disaster kills 172 coal miners near Castle Gate in Utah. 1936, Daytona Beach and Load Course holds its first oval stock car race. 1937, Spanish Civil War. Battle of Guadalajara begins. 1942, World War II. The Dutch East Indies surrender Java to the Imperial Japanese Army. 1942, World War II. Imperial Japanese Army forces capture Rangoon, Burma from the British. 1950, the iconic Volkswagen Type 2 bus begins production on this date. 1963, the Ba'ath Party comes to power in Syria in a coup d'etat. 1965, Vietnam War. U.S. Marines arrive in Da Nang. 1966, Nelson's Pillar in Dublin, Ireland, destroyed by a bomb. For those not familiar with Nelson's Pillar, it's also simply known as the Pillar. was a large granite column capped by a statue of Horatio Nelson built in the center of what was then Sackville Street. Later, it was renamed O'Connell Street in Dublin, Ireland. Completed in 1809, when Ireland was part of the UK, it survived till March of 1966 when it was severely damaged by explosives planted by Irish Republicans. The remnants were later destroyed by the Irish Army. Nothing is sacred. 1979, Phillips demonstrates the compact disc publicly for the first time. 1979, images taken by Voyager 1 proved the existence of volcanoes on Io, a moon of Jupiter. 1983, Cold War. While addressing a convention of evangelicals, U.S. President Ronald Reagan labels the Soviet Union an evil empire. 1985, a supposed failed assassination attempt on Islamic cleric Sayyid Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah in Beirut, Lebanon, killed 80 and injured 200 others. 1988, Aeroflot Flight 3379 is hijacked by the Ovechkin family and diverted to Vyshevo in the Soviet Union. 2004, a new constitution signed by Iraq's governing council. 2014, in one of aviation's greatest mysteries, Malaysia Flight 370, carrying 239 people, vanishes as en route to from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. They still have no earthly idea what happened to that aircraft or the 239 people on board. A lot of theories, but no evidence supporting any of them. 2017, the Asia Window Natural Arch on the Maltese island of Gozo collapses in stormy weather. 2018, the first Orat March, it's a social-political demonstration, was held during International Women's Day in Karachi, Pakistan. Since then, annually held across Pakistan, and the feminist slogan, Mera Izzat Meri Marzi, My Body, My Choice, and a demand for women's right to bodily autonomy and against gender-based violence came into vogue in Pakistan. 2021 International Women's Day marches in Mexico became violent with 62 police officers and 19 civilians injured in Mexico City alone. And in 2021, 28 political institutions in Myanmar established a National Unity Consultative Council, a historic alliance of ethnic armed organizations and democratically elected leaders in response to the 2021 Myanmar coup d'etat. Certainly, there's a lot of, confusion about who's doing what to who in many of these countries. Some have demonstrations just for the purpose of having a demonstration. And everybody wants to be an activist. It seems to be romanticized to the point of literally stupidity. Well, we've been talking about Hollywood mysteries. We're going to continue today and tomorrow. Next week we'll have a new topic. You know, we've talked about murders and we've talked about suicides, and sometimes the death is just puzzling. It makes no sense whatsoever. For example, the death of Russ Colombo, who was born Ruggiero Eugenio di Rodolfo Colombo. Now, sometimes the cause of a particular death is so fantastic it's difficult to accept it as an accident, even years later. And that such was the case of singer Russ Colombo, who in the early 1930s rivaled Bing Crosby and Rudy Vallee as America's most popular singer. Born in San Francisco in 1908, the youngest of 12 children. When he was five, the family relocated to Philadelphia, later moved back to the West Coast, and by that point in time, Russ had learned the violin and began studying opera. During his high school years in L.A., he earned money as a violinist, often playing background music during the shooting of silent pictures. caught the attention of screen star Polo Negri, who was attracted by his resemblance to Rudolph Valentino. And she found Colombo more work, both playing music and doing film bits. When he graduated from high school, he joined George Eckhart and his orchestra and moved on to other performing groups. With Professor Moore and his orchestra, he played violin at Los Angeles Roosevelt Hotel. Occasionally got to be the group substitute singer. Break came in 1928 when he was signed to join Gus Arnheim and his orchestra at L.A.'s Swank Coconut Grove Club. Played violin and was backup to Bing Crosby. And sometimes he and Crosby did duets. And it was these appearances that led to Colombo getting small roles in talkies. And his first one was Street Girl in 1929. Had a non-musical acting part in Wolf Song, 1929, which starred Latin bombshell Lupe Velez, and who took a romantic interest in him, as well as in co-star Gary Cooper. Then in 1929, he also did Cecil B. DeMille's Dynamite. He was a Mexican prisoner who introduced the popular song How Am I to Know. By 1930, he made his recording debut and toured the East Coast with Arnheim's group. And of course, since the public liked him, more film roles came his way. Well, always anxious to improve himself, he formed his own band. Then he opened his own nightery, the Club Pyramid, on Santa Monica Boulevard. And this exposure led to an RCA recording contract, and then he landed his own NBC network radio program. Soon he was getting sacks of fang mail and was dubbed the Romeo Radio. Well, his recordings, which included his theme song, You Call It Madness, became bestsellers. And he was a sensation. He did sell-out personal appearance tours. Publicity mill insisted he was dating Greta Garbo, and actuality, a romance actress, Dorothy Dell, who died in a car crash in 1934. Sally Blaine and Carol Lombard were two other romantic interests. Romance with Carol blossomed. He dedicated his song Save the Last Dance for Me to her. Her romance seesawed as she suspected that his old world ways, traditional Catholic upbringing, wouldn't sit well with her freer lifestyle. Nevertheless, they were unofficially engaged to marry. And by this point in time, he was generally earning at least $7,500 a week. For his first major feature film, Broadway Through a Keyhole, 1933, he got very positive notices. More for his pleasing personality and vocal abilities and for his dramatics. He formed a music publishing company, had a new Sunday night NBC radio program, and signed a long-term deal with Universal Pictures to make a string of musicals, including a remake of Showboat. Well, as luck would have it, he made only one. 1934 was Wake Up and Dream, song and dance affair about a vaudeville performer. And he told the press, I find that I've just about everything I want from life. I'm pretty happy about the things that have worked out for me. But by the time his breakthrough screen vehicle was released to the public, he was dead. Well, according to the story, Friday night, August 31st, 1934, he and Carol Lombard dressed in disguise to attend a sneak preview of Wake Up and Live. During the weekend, he and Carol argued, and on Sunday, September 2nd, he was at 916 North Janice in West Hollywood visiting a very close friend, Hollywood portrait photographer Lansing Brown. The two were chatting and examining Brown's collection of Civil War dueling pistols. Brown supposedly struck a match on one of the firearms, which had been loaded years before. The charge exploded from the pistol, ricocheted off a nearby desk, and bounced back and hit Colombo in the left eye. He collapsed as the corroded pellet lodged in his brain, rushed by ambulance to Los Angeles Good Samaritan Hospital, where he died 2 hours later. never even regained consciousness. So the blame was the hospital when he passed away at the age of 26. Buried at Forest Lawn Memorial Gardens in Glendale. Among his pallbearers were Bing Crosby, Zippo Marx, Delectra Lou Sherman, and Carol Lombard's brother Stuart. Carol hadn't intended to attend the funeral, but she did and broke down during the services. She was consoled by Bing Crosby. Later, she tried to comfort Brown, who suffered tremendous guilt over causing his friend's death. Well, bizarre as the facts about his death, the aftermath was even stranger. His mother never did learn of his death. 2 days before Russ died, the blind woman suffered a severe heart attack, and family feared the news of his death would finish her. So they concocted, supposed that Carol's suggestion, the story he had sailed on a legendary lengthy tour abroad. Made up letters to read to her every week, supposedly sent by her son. Monthly checks were given to her by his insurance policies. This deception went on for a decade till she died. Her final words before she breathed her last was, "Tell Rush how happy and proud he's made me." In fact, in her will, she left part of her estate to him. Well, over the real years, rumors persisted as to the real story behind Columbo's bizarre death. But nothing is ever proven one way or another. When his older brother, Alberto, was found murdered, gangland style, in March of 1954, there was fresh speculation maybe Russia's strange end hadn't been as accidental as it was made to seem in 1934. And if anybody does know the real facts, they're not talking. That's assuming anybody that would know those facts is still alive. Well, of course, we've talked several times about the bizarre death of Bob Crane. Colonel Hogan from Hogan's Heroes. And if it were not for constant reruns of Hogan's Heroes and his bizarre death, Bob Crane might just be another footnote in TV history. However, his unsolved brutal murder and the constant playing of the 167 episodes of the life and zany times of Colonel Hogan in a World War II Nazi prisoner of war camp has certainly kept his memory very much alive. Born in Waterbury, Connecticut, and grew up in Stamford. Earning his life, he developed an enthusiasm for playing the drums. Musical talent that ended up becoming a percussionist with the Connecticut Symphony Orchestra from 1944 to 1946. Later toured the Northeast with various bands. 1950, he turned to being a disc jockey and radio host on local radio stations. First in Hornell, New York, and then in Bristol, Connecticut, and then in Bridgeport, Connecticut for 6 years. Married his childhood sweetheart, Ann Terzian, 1949. They divorced in 1970, but before they did, they had three children, Robert David, Deborah Ann, and Karen Leslie. Well, Crane's media experience as a ingratiating radio personality with easygoing clowning manner led to his coming to L.A. And in L.A. on KNX Radio, he hosted a celebrity interview show. Displayed a sharp wit and an entertaining brashness. Well, before too long, he's earning over $100,000 a year. But his ambition, and he wasn't shy about saying it, was to be an actor. He told a friend, "I want to be the next Jack Lemmon." But his radio duty stood in the way. Industry contacts led to occasional TV guest spots. He was on the I Love Lucy show, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Did several movies, Man Trap in 61, Return to Peyton Place in 61. He was a substitute host for Johnny Carson on a daytime quiz show, Who Do You Trust? Well, in addition to TV work, he also did stock performances. And he was a frequent volunteer on benefit shows. He appeared on TV's Dick Van Dyke Show in 63 and led to him playing Dr. Dave Kelsey, who married the next-door neighbor. Or he was the married next-door neighbor in Donna Reed Show. And from that casting, He wound up being cast as a resourceful American colonel in Hogan's Heroes. It was Crane's character, along with his fellow Allied prisoners, who made monkeys out of the Germans. In 1970, 4 months after his divorce from his first wife was final, he married actress Patricia Olsen. And you, I'm sure, have seen her under her stage name of Sigrid Valdez. She played Hilda, the German Fraulein on Hogan's Heroes from 1966 to 1970. Next year, the couple had a son, Robert Scott. And when Crane's series went off the air, he was confident his success would lead to a prompt follow-up vehicle. Guest starred in many TV shows and made-for-TV movies. Turned down several sitcom plots. 1974, he rejected a $300,000 a year offer to do a Los Angeles radio show 4 hours per week. A weekday, I'm sorry. He insisted. I said no because that's going backward. I enjoy acting too much. And finally, he got the opportunity to do the Bob Crane show, which lasted 2 months in 1975. Its failure left the on-the-surface congenial performer bitter. Late 70s, he was a guest on Love Boat, sure sign of career problems, and had only a supporting role in the Disney comedy feature Gus in 1976. And he starred for the studio in an earlier comedy known as Call Super Dad in 1974. Well, in 78, he was separated from his second wife. She actually filed for divorce. Was hoping for a TV series comeback. Was earning a lucrative salary performing in light comedies at dinner theaters throughout the U.S. And, of course, the Hogan Heroes reruns kept his name alive to audiences. And part of his reason for working so hard was his manager informed him that his finances were shaky. It proved, later showed that substantial funds had been embezzled from his accounts. June of 78, he was starring in a sex farce, Beginner's Luck, at the Windmill Dinner Theater in Scottsdale, Arizona. That's a well-known retirement community. He was lodged at the Winfield Apartment Hotel and Grand Floor rooms released by the theater for visiting star cast. A few weeks before his death, his second wife, Patricia, and their son made a surprise visit to Scottsdale. Ended up with several noisy arguments before she and the boy flew back to the West Coast. Wednesday, June 28, 1978, after completing the evening show and signing autographs for fans in the lobby, Crane returned briefly to his apartment for a longtime friend, Los Angeles businessman John Carpenter. Before they left, Patricia had called him from Seattle, where she was vacationing, and had argued loudly on the phone, according to Carpenter. After that, Crane and Carpenter adjourned to a local bar where they had drinks with two women whom they had arranged to meet there. About 2 in the morning, the quartet went to the Safari Coffee Shop on Scottsdale Road. And at about 2:30, Carpenter left to pack for his trip back to L.A., Once back in his hotel room, he called Crane one final time. Well, about 2:20 p.m. on June 29, 1978, Victoria Berry, a blonde Australian actress who was in the touring cast of Beginner's Luck and who had become very friendly with Crane, arrived at the Winfield Apartments. Bob Crane had failed to appear for a cast lunch or to keep a later appointment to help her with audition tapes to further her own career. Found the front door of his two-bedroom apartment unlocked, and Crane was well-known for always double-locking his doors. When she went in, the curtains were drawn, and with two bottles on a table. Crane was not a heavy drinker. When she went into the master bedroom, she found Crane dead, hunched up in bed, lying on his side, wearing undershorts and an undershirt. And his face was so battered, at first she didn't realize it was him. And she saw his watch, knew the corpse was out of Bob Crane, screamed, and her screaming led to the police being called. Police theorized that the killer, they didn't know if it was a he or a she, it was somebody that Crane knew and had left the apartment and had returned, having left the front door or window unlocked. According to the medical examiner, somewhere in the early hours of Thursday, June 29th, while Crane slipped on his right side. He was hit a heavy blow on the left side of his head with a blunt object and a second lighter one which crushed the man's skull. Video camera electrical cord had been tied tightly around his neck, but by that time he's already dead. Before fleeing, the killer wiped the blood off the murder weapon onto the bed sheets and pulled the sheet up around the victim's head. Robbery was ruled out as a motive because cash was found in his wallet, which was still in his clothing. Investigation of the crime by the local police brought to light that Bob Crane had a secret life, which he pursued in Scottsdale as he had for several years before. Long-standing compulsion to videotape himself and his female sexual partners, of which there had been a lot over the years, in various sexual acts. It was rumored that this activity, as well as other penchants playing drums at various topless bars in L.A., supposed to cost Crane several TV and movie acting jobs. Producers feel for of having their screen product associated with this very two-sided man. Approximately 50 such tapes were found at the Winfield apartment, as well as professional photography equipment in the bathroom for developing and enlarging still shots. Negative strip was found still in the enlarger, revealing a female in both clothed and nude poses. A very heavy album of similar such pornographic pictures was missing from the death scene. A number of items were actually missing from Crane's little black bag, a small multi-zippered bag which he always carried around with him. Barry had seen it when she first discovered the body, but later it disappeared and was never accounted for. Police never had any explanation for what happened to it. And because of Crane's unusual taste, police insisted there could be a lot of potential suspects, including disgruntled husbands or jealous female partners. At one point, John Carpenter was considered a prime suspect for the murder, but no official charges have ever been brought against him. And it was on July 5th, 1978, 8 days before his 50th birthday, that services were held for Bob Crane at St. Paul the Apostle Catholic Church in Westwood, California. His family, which included both wives and all the children, and 200 mourners, including celebrity attendees Carol O'Connor, John and Patty Duke Aston, attended the services. Pallbearers, including several Hogan Hero alumni, such as Leon Askin, Eric Braden, Robert Clary, and Larry Hovis. Because of Bob Crane's fame, his murder was news everywhere for a long time. And when the local police couldn't conclusively name or arrest a suspect in the case, a lot of professional amateurs around the country tried their hand at solving this puzzling, complex case. A lot of the theories have been put forth. A great deal of discussion is focused on the quality of the police investigation and the jurisdictional and political controversy the case caused. But to this date, the killer remains at large, although recurringly Scottsdale police insist the case will soon be solved. They've been saying that since his death. Well, on our list of puzzling deaths, we have Dorothy Dandridge. Died in 1965. In early to mid-20th century, North America show business was one of the few areas in which a black performer was allowed to excel. But even in the entertainment field, it's difficult for a black star to find leading roles, especially in motion pictures. One of the many talented, ambitious entertainers who fought to break through the bias was sultry, coffee-colored Dorothy Dandridge. A professional heartbreak sustained her in crashing the color line. Haunted her to the end of her life. By the time she was born in Cleveland, Ohio, 1922, one of two children of actress Ruby Dandridge, her father had vanished. Very early age, she and her older sister Vivian, billed as the wonderful children, performed before local church and school groups and soon were touring the country. By the early 1930s, Ms. Dandridge took her children to L.A. Dorothy dropped out of high school and she began getting film roles. Background parts in the Marx Brothers, A Day at the Races in 37, and Dick Powell's Going Places in 38. With Etta Jones added to the act, Dorothy and Vivian toured as the Dandridge sisters. Well, by now, Ruby Dandridge herself was getting a foothold in movies, playing domestics, and hired a chaperone to be with her girls when they toured. Always idealistic and shy, Dorothy was traumatized one night when she returned home from a date and this hostile, domineering woman in charge accused her of sexual promiscuity. To determine if the girl was still a virgin, she tore off Dorothy's dress and poked inside the horrified girl with her finger. Nightmarish situation left Dandridge frigid for a number of years. 1940, while performing with Jimmy Lanceville's band at the Cotton Club in New York, Dorothy met Harold Nichols. Nicholas. Part of the popular Nicholas Brothers dance act and quite a ladies' man. Dorothy and Nicholas began dating, which continued when they were both cast in Sun Valley Serenade in 1941 back in Hollywood. They married in 1942 and her daughter, Harolyn, was born the next year. Unfortunately, the infant was brain damaged, a malady for which Dandridge never forgave herself. Meanwhile, Dorothy continued to gain small roles in Hollywood features. Well, Dandridge and Nicholas divorced in the late 1940s. She admitted, "I think it was really the heartache over my child and the failure of my marriage that forced me to make a success in my career. I had to keep busy." Took acting lessons and through the guidance of musician Paul Moore, who became a romantic interest as well, she emerged a confident, sexy chanteuse. She sang briefly with Desi Arnaz's band at the Bogambo Club in Hollywood. Took the role of a erotic jungle princess in Tarzan's Peril in 1951. Played a sports player's wife in the Harlem Globetrotters in 1951. Singing engagements in increasingly posh West and East Coast nightclubs, her popularity grew. MGM cast her as a dedicated school teacher in Bright Road in 1953, and she revealed a hidden dramatic metal. Well, in a singing engagement in Cleveland, she finally met her father, Cyril Dandridge, and from this one-time-only meeting, she learned she was one-quarter white. Well, Dorothy campaigned hard to win the Temptress title role in Carmen Jones in 54, opposite her Bright Road co-star, Halle Belafonte. But once she won the battle, she was overwhelmed with self-doubts. She was a perpetual perfectionist, always striving to please everybody. Still had little faith in herself. Her doubts were reinforced when the film's director, Otto Preminger, hired a young opera student, Marilyn Horn, to dub Dandridge's voice for the difficult score. Nevertheless, Dorothy was Oscar nominated for her fiery performance in 20th Century, signed her to a non-exclusive contract. On screen, she embarked in an interracial romance, An Island in the Sun, in 57, and played a half-caste in Tamango in 1959. Off-screen, she won a lawsuit against a Confidential magazine for a scandalous article it published about her off-camera sex life. And she returned to screen musicals with Porgy and Bess in 1959, directed by her mentor tormentor, Otto Preminger. That year, she wed her longtime romance, white restaurateur Jack Dennison. Well, by the early 1960s, her screen career was stalled due to the lack of available roles for a black leading woman, and her unhappy, costly marriage ended in divorce in 1962. Unable to cope with her growing frustration, she began to drink heavily. When she could no longer afford to keep her retarded daughter in a private hospital, she had her committed to the Camarillo State Hospital. Well, Dorothy tried hard to revive her career, but her emotional and physical health had been depleted by over-reliance on liquor and pills. April of 63, she declared bankruptcy, making public just how bad her life had become. Well, with the assistance of her one-time manager, Earl Mills, she straightened out and made a few singing engagements, including playing Julie in a summer stock edition of Showboat, which starred Katherine Grayson. Mid-September 1965, she was scheduled to appear at Manhattan's Basin Street East. She insisted she was going to set New York on their ears, and she had been offered two new film projects in Mexico. Well, the day before she went to Mexico to discuss the contract, she twisted her ankle and fell down the steps of a local gym and began to paint her en route south of the border. September 7th, as soon as she returned from Mexico, she consulted L.A. doctor who found that she had suffered a minor fracture. He arranged for her to come back the next day to have a small plaster cast applied to her ankle. That evening, she packed for the New York flight and talked with her mother on the phone. Next morning at 7:15, she called Earl Mills, asking him to postpone the hospital appointment for a few hours. She said, "I'll sleep for a while and I'll be fine." And she hung up. Later in the morning, Mills couldn't reach her by phone. Drove to her West Hollywood apartment, but there was no answer. Left and came back at 2 p.m. Now worried, he forced his entry into the place and found her lying on the bathroom floor. She was naked except for a scarf wrapped around her head. When the ambulance arrived, the medics confirmed she'd been dead for about 2 hours. Strangely, a few months before her death, she had handed Mills a note, later declared to be her last will and testament. And that note said, "In case of my death, whoever discovers it, don't remove anything I have on, scarf, gown, or underwear. Cremate me right away. If I have anything, money, furniture, give it to my mother, Ruby Dandridge. She'll know what to do with it." And it's signed Dorothy Dandridge. Well, the L.A. coroner's office concluded initially that Dorothy died of an embolism caused by fatty bits dislodged from the bone marrow in her fractured right foot, which had cut off the blood flow to her lungs and brain. A few weeks later, a new medical finding was released. Further study of tissue samples showed that she had suffered a drug overdose from Trefenil, an antidepressant which doctors had prescribed for her. Because of the career upswing Dorothy was undergoing at the time of her death, the psychiatric team refused to conclude definitely she was a suicide victim. Officially, the case is still unresolved. Well, she died at age 41 with only a few dollars in her bank account. It was a sad end to such a promising career. Then we have Albert Dekker. Real name, Albert Van Dekker. Died in 1968. You know, in Hollywood's history, there have been many grotesque deaths and murders. But few have been as weird as that of Albert Dekker, the distinguished mustachioed character actor. Specialized in playing polished, squinty-eyed villains. Born in Brooklyn, he graduated from Bowdoin College, intended to follow a career in psychology and maybe become a psychiatrist, but he became interested in acting on campus and made his professional debut in 1927 with a Cincinnati stock company. That same year, he came to Broadway in Marco's Millions, followed by several other stage roles, including Grand Hotel in 1930 and Parnell in 1935. Married actress Esther Gonini in 1929 and had three children, Jan, John, and Benjamin. Made his movie debut in The Great Garrick in 1937. And he was constantly working. The 6'3", 240-pound Dekker became a highly respected character lead, usually cast as a menacing crook or a demented scientist. One of his most famous was Dr. Cyclops in 1940. I love that film. Won a seat in the California State Assembly in 1944 and worked as a public servant for 2 years. Then he returned to making movies, including The Killers in 1946 and The Furious in 1950. Went back to Broadway in 1950 to take over the lead in Death of a Salesman. He also spoke out against Senator Joseph McCarthy's communist witch hunt. He was blacklisted into industry as a result. April 18, 1957, Dexter's... Okay. April 18, 1957. His 16-year-old son John died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound at the family home in Hastings-on-Hudson. After an investigation, it was ruled to be accidental. 1959, he was again making major films. Suddenly Last Summer and In the Middle of the Night, was on Broadway in the Andersonville Trial in 1960 and The Devils in 1965. His final roles in Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch, which was actually released after his death in 1969. The time of his passing, he'd long been divorced from his wife and been dating Geraldine Saunders for some time. With his $30,000 salary from The Wild Bunch and $40,000 from TV work, he and his fiancée planned to buy a house in the Encino Hills area of the San Fernando Valley. Saturday, May 4th, Saunders couldn't get in touch with Dekker, who she'd last seen 2 days before. Sunday morning, she rushed over to his apartment at 1731 North Normandy Street in Hollywood and found a number of notes on the door from friends trying to reach him. You know, she slipped her own message under that locked door, and that evening, when she still hadn't heard from him, she went back. Accompanied by the manager, they entered the locked but unbolted front door of the apartment. And when the manager forced open the bathroom door, the sight was so horrendous that Saunders fainted. The once distinguished actress found kneeling naked in the bathtub. Dirty hypodermic needle was stuck in each arm. Around his neck was a hangman's noose, loose enough not to strangle him. There was a scarf wrapped around his eyes and a rubber ball bed in his mouth with metal chains tied firmly behind his head. And his body was trussed up in several leather belts, fastened around his body halter fashion with the end of a belt rope tied around his middle, leading to the rope's end clutched in his hand. On his wrists were each handcuffed separately. Obscene writings and symbols covered his body. On his chest was written cocksucker and slave, and on his throat was make me suck. Police investigation uncovered no signs of forced entry or struggle. Several thousand dollars in cash and camera equipment were missing. While admitting it was an unusual case, the official verdict was accidental death, not a suicide. L.A. County Coroner Thomas Noguchi had his own opinion. He thought the sophisticated decorator died of the not uncommon autoerotic asphyxia, which heightened orgasm in achieving where heightened orgasm is achieved by risking death. Well, friends insisted they'd never known him to be kinky, nor did they think of him as a closeted gay man. For a brief period, the police speculated he may have been killed by a male hustler who'd been involved in a ritual gone bad and left the apartment quickly, taking what valuables he could grab. And while the case was officially closed, it's still a confusing Hollywood mystery that doesn't look like it's going to be solved anytime soon. Then we have a name that still resounds even today, Mario Lanza, born Alfred Arnold Cocoza, died in 1959. Everything about Mario Lanza was enormous. His talent, his ego, his lifestyle, and even his weight. In his relatively short career, he made only 8 feature films. But the legacy of his golden operatic tenor voice is guaranteed by his many recordings that to date have sold over 50 million copies. And his untimely death was brought on by a reckless living style and his irresolute battle to curb his ever-ballooning figure. He was born in South Philadelphia in 1921. His father was disabled in World War I. The family survived on the earnings of Mrs. Cocoza, a seamstress. His father was an avid opera fan and instilled a love of music in his son. Alfred, known as Freddie, listened to Enrico Caruso's recordings constantly on a neighbor's phonograph and grew up idolizing Caruso. Freddie had little interest in academics, but enjoyed school sports, chasing girls, and taking vocal lessons, for which his mother had to scrape to pay. A few months before graduation, he was expelled from high school and went to work at his grandfather's grocery store. Stayed there for 3 years until his voice coach, Irwin Williams, arranged an audition at the Philadelphia Academy of Music. And that audition led to a scholarship at the Berkshire Music Center in Tanglewood, based in Lenox, Massachusetts. By now, he had adopted his mother's maiden name of Lanza and adapted her first name of Mario, Maria, changing it to Mario. Well, he made his Tanglewood debut in the opera The Merry Wives of Windsor in the summer of 42 and went on a concert tour. Promising career was cut short when he was drafted into World War II duty the next January. Because of his singing skills, he was assigned to the Army Special Services and was cast in their production of On the Beam and Wing Victory. Toured with the latter show on the West Coast, where actress Irene Manning was so impressed with his talent, she had him audition for Jack Warner. And because he weighed at that time over 250 pounds, the Warner Brothers chief dismissed his screen potential. Later, Lanza sang at a party hosted by Frank Sinatra and found himself an agent, Art Rush, who got him a RCA Victor recording contract. Early 45, Lanza had been discharged from the service, and by that April, he had married Betty Hicks, the sister of an Army friend. He went on to have 4 children, Colleen, Elisha, Damon, and Mark. In 1947, he gave a sensational concert at the Hollywood Bowl. After enjoying the performance, MGM head Louis B. Mayer signed Lontard a 7-year movie contract at $750 a week. It may not sound like a lot, but for 1947, that was good money. His screen debut was in The Midnight Kiss in 49, followed by The Toast of New Orleans in 1950, both opposite Catherine Grayson. Inflated by the progress of his career so far, ego-inflated Mario insisted his next vehicle has to be based on the life of the legendary Caruso. And it was. The Great Caruso, 1951, grossed $4.5 million at the box office. However, by now, Lonzo was becoming increasingly temperamental and so crude at times that the actresses shuddered at the thought of working with him. Well, the studio announced that Lonzo would next star in the Sigmund Rumberg operetta, The Student Prince, in 1954. However, after pre-recording his songs, Mario got into a dispute with the studio and left the film. MGM sued him, and when a new regime came on the lot, a compromise was reached. Filming began, but more bad words were exchanged, and Lonzo again left the project. Eventually, Mario, who by now had become grossly overweight, agreed to permit his singing voice to be used, while handsome, thin Edmund Pardon mouthed the words as the on-screen lead. Lonzo's studio contract was over, and the hot-tempered star pouted. I rebel because of my sincerity to the public in my career. October 1954, he made his dramatic debut on TV in Lindenere. Because of his crash dieting, just grapefruit and booze, his voice had grown weak, and it was decided to dub him using his own recordings. Word of this circulated in the industry. He lost out on the starring role in The Vagabond King in 1956. Suffered the humiliation of being replaced by Oreste, a relative unknown. And his career wouldn't help when he suddenly canceled a Las Vegas club engagement in the mid-50s because his habit of mixing champagne and tranquilizers had gotten the better of him. Needing fresh cash to support his luxuriant lifestyle, Lonzo convinced Warner Brothers to hire him at $150,000 a picture. After the moderately successful Serenade in 56, the studio decided it could do without the troublesome Lonzo and cancel the remaining pictures. Lonzo went on concert tours, but they weren't sufficient to support his family and himself. Well, if Hollywood studio would wash their hands of him, Lonzo's name was still magic in Europe, and he signed a two-picture deal with an Italian company. Buoyed by the turn of events, he grandiosely rented a luxurious Rome villa, reasoning, I'm a movie star and I ought to live like one. 1958 production of Seven Hills of Rome had gorgeous, colorful scenery, plus Mario singing Come Prima and Rivoderci Roma. And congruously, that and his next picture were released by Mario's old studio, MGM, which had a distribution deal with the Italian company. Well, the peaks and valleys of his flamboyant career and the indulgent lifestyle that didn't teach him anything. He was convinced he could continue his eating, drinking binges and compensate by going on crash diets amid 80 by foods, depressant drugs. But the cumulative strain on his heart was tremendous. About that time, he met exiled gangster Lucky Luciano, who suggested Mario sing at an upcoming charity gala in Naples. When Lonzo failed to attend a scheduled rehearsal, two thugs visited him to convince him not to back out. Determined not to perform, Mario checked into a Rome clinic for a new weight loss regime. Doctors insisted his heart had gone and bad, and while his wife was informed he was suffering from the combined effects of pneumonia and phlebitis, Lonzo's driver came to visit and found the singer comatose, an empty intravenous tube pumping air into his veins. October 7, 1959, Lonzo was dead. Official cause listed as a heart attack. But nobody was certain what the actual true cause was. He was only 38 years old. March 11, 1960, Betty Lonzo, who had been in a constant depression since Lonzo's death, died of asphyxiation brought on by a regimen of alcohol and pills. She was buried at Los Angeles Holy Cross Cemetery, together with Mario Lonzo, whose body had previously listed at the Calvary Cemetery. Well, with their parents' deaths, the four Lonzo children were temporarily cared for by Catherine Grayson and then were made wards of Lonzo's parents. But they were actually raised by Lonzo's personal manager, Terry Robinson. Lonzo's daughter, Colleen, was the only offspring to become a singer. Lonzo's last-born, Charles Mark, died in Los Angeles in 1991 at the age of 37. No, the cause of death was never revealed. A lot of mystery there still. Well, on that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow and talk about more mysterious deaths. Until then, Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.